Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman. Days after the worst mass shooting in American history, how does Hawaii measure up when it comes to gun safety? We'll have a comparison with the rest of the country, including where we fall short, at least in the eyes of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Too much of a good thing. That might describe reef fishing in Hawaii. That's one finding of a new study, the largest of its kind. We'll talk to its lead author, Alan Friedlander. And you've heard about the Peace Corps and Teach for America. How about Report for America? It's one of the country's newest service organizations. We'll talk with the co-founder, who says this country's communities need help with local news. It's Thursday, October 5th, day 9 of our fall pledge drive. Those conversations and more right after the news. The initial shock of Sunday's night's mass shooting in Las Vegas may have worn a bit thinner, but the sadness lingers. And as stories of survival and investigation continue, another focus shifts to the question of gun control. While this may or may not be an issue the U.S. Congress deals with beyond those so-called bump stocks, it is something that state legislatures address, including here in Hawaii. Hannah Shearer is staff attorney and Second Amendment litigation director at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. She joined us earlier for a conversation from San Francisco. Hannah, thanks for joining us this morning. You know, the discussion over gun control is often framed on a national level, but your group sees the state and local level as essential to this. Tell us more about that perspective.
You're right that we do see it as essential because actually, while federal progress has stalled in recent years, a number of states have stepped up to pass stronger gun laws, particularly in the wake of the terrible shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. So we've seen a lot of progress on the state level, and we've also noticed a correlation that states with stronger gun laws experience lower gun death rates per capita. So it's an indication to us that our gun policies that we support are working on the state level.
That discussion about who gets legislative priority, the federal versus state, I mean, this has been a discussion that's been going on since Hamilton and Jefferson. How, for gun control, how is that playing out?
Well, I think there are many advantages to having federal gun policy because one state's gun laws are only as strong as the neighboring states, which, of course, you know, in Hawaii is a different story, but you know, in places like Chicago, Illinois has relatively strong gun laws, but the neighboring states have weaker laws, and so there's lots of guns coming in from other states. So it's important to support federal policies, but unfortunately, Congress has really abdicated its responsibility in many ways, including after Sandy Hook, when many people thought that finally progress would be made with background checks, and nothing happened. It's a tricky political environment right now federally, and there are things that states can do even if Congress doesn't act. And we've seen that in states like Hawaii, as well as in California, other western states as well.
And you do that state analysis on gun laws, and Hawaii scores pretty well on that. You give an overall grade of B+, and you point out also that Hawaii is the lowest of all the states in terms of gun deaths. What is it that has helped Hawaii on the positive side of gun legislation and regulation?
We certainly think Hawaii's laws are fairly strong. Hawaii has a good background check system in place and also has a more recent law known as the wrap back system that tries to make sure that people who buy a gun and then become prohibited from owning it are identified by law enforcement. Hawaii also restricts assault weapons and large capacity magazines, and has child access prevention law, and also prohibits the sale of unsafe handguns. I'll also point out that Hawaii has not only low rates of gun death, but also low gun suicide rates, which is another important indicator that we look for in terms of states that have made progress in reducing gun deaths.
One area where you say that Hawaii could do better is to enact legislation that would require the removal of firearms when a temporary restraining order is issued relating to domestic violence. Why is that so critical and such a key piece to this overall puzzle of gun violence in America?
Well, a lot of gun violence in America is, unfortunately, domestic gun violence. You know, abusers that have firearms are much more likely to injure or kill their intimate partners than if they don't have firearms. And there's often a very critical period after a victim of domestic abuse seeks help, you know, gets a restraining order. That can trigger a very dangerous period where the abuser wants to retaliate. We always recommend that states focus on that period of time and protecting women when they're potentially most vulnerable. And so a key element of that is the temporary restraining order.
Are there particular states that you see as models on this domestic violence situation, the TROs relating to gun violence?
I'd point to California. California has good laws around domestic violence and firearms generally, but one recent change that strengthened the law was to set out specific relinquishment procedures to make sure that when a person is ordered by a court to give up firearms in connection with a domestic violence restraining order, there's an enforceable and orderly process for the court to make sure that the firearms are turned in. And that's a missing piece in many states' laws. A lot of states kind of have a system that's like the honor system, like somebody who becomes prohibited is just told to turn in their guns, but there isn't an enforcement process. And so that is, I think, a critical distinction why California's law is stronger.
You mentioned suicides, you mentioned domestic violence. A piece in the Washington Post citing work done by the data journalism site 538 goes through 33,000 lives ended each year by gun violence in America. Two-thirds of those are suicides. Next largest set of gun deaths, young men between 15 and 34, mostly dying at the hands of other young men. And the third highest is related to domestic violence, 1,700 women murdered each year. When you look at those three big pieces of gun violence, do you see positive movement on any of them, on a combination of them, or where's your sense of where we are nationally?
Sure, and I think that those three are all critical areas where we've seen some progress in some states, but maybe not in every state. The domestic violence piece is interesting because it cuts across party lines. We've seen states that are controlled by Republicans, like Louisiana, that have high gun death rates, high gun ownership rates, still take steps to protect domestic abuse victims from gun violence. So that's one issue that I think can get bipartisan support and can be enacted even in states that have very weak laws overall. To address suicide and interpersonal conflicts between young men, I think sometimes those pieces are overlooked a little bit. And my organization recently did an extensive research project on gun suicides, and our goal was to combat the inevitability myth, the idea that suicides are going to happen no matter what the laws are, no matter what the gun laws are. And in reality, gun laws can make a huge difference in gun suicides just because if somebody who's suicidal doesn't have immediate access to a gun, the impulse might pass away and they might be able to get help for their mental health problems. So suicide is what we call means-specific, and by tightening gun laws around people who are mentally ill, who are suicidal, lives can be saved.
You know, Hannah, when a mass shooting occurs, an event like Las Vegas, there's always the spike in attention to gun control, but it seems that it does not linger. How, from your position, do you maintain a focus on that legislative groundwork that's required for any changes in the laws, and be that nationally or state by state or locally?
My organization tries to keep pushing our legislators to do the right thing, on the one hand, but then also to listen to voters, because what becomes so clear in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy like this is that most people want to improve our gun policies. Most people think this is unacceptable, like something has to be done. And it's really groups on the fringe, groups like the NRA that aren't necessarily even representing the views of their members, but are representing the views of an extreme minority of their membership that are standing in the way. And so part of it is just reminding our representatives that most Americans, the overwhelming majority, over 90%, support common sense measures like background checks, support restricting access to incredibly dangerous, you know, accessories that turn an assault weapon into a machine gun, things like that. And so I think it's important to just remember that this is common ground, so progress is possible.
Hannah Shearer is staff attorney and Second Amendment litigation director at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Hannah, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Hawaii's reef fish are being overfished. That's the conclusion of the largest study of its kind ever put together. It included information compiled by researchers and multiple government agencies going back to the year 2000. It also made use of more than 25,000 in-water surveys. Alan Friedlander is the lead author of the study. He's the chief scientist for National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project and director of the Fisheries Ecology Research Lab at the University of Hawaii, and he joins us live in the studio this morning. Alan, thanks for being here. And what do you think is the most important finding out of this study?
Thanks for having me, Bill. Yeah, I think over the course of the study, what we found is there is a good news and bad news story. There are places within the main Hawaiian Islands, particularly around the populated areas, that have suffered significantly from overfishing, as well as other things like pollution and coastal development, primarily around Oahu and parts of Maui. But there's also places around the state that look amazing, remote areas like Niihau, Ko'olawe, North Shore, Molokai, Hamakua Coast. So these areas look more like the northwestern Hawaiian Islands than they do the main Hawaiian Islands. So I think there's hope for a lot of the reefs in the middle there, so we can learn lessons from what has worked elsewhere and what hasn't worked.
Speaking of learning lessons, you compared fish density across the islands by moku, which is a traditional Hawaiian resource management tool. Can you explain that a bit more?
Sure. So aupua'a, or watersheds, were nested within moku, and moku represent basic biophysical properties, windward areas, leeward, north shore, south shore. So they made a lot of sense from a biological standpoint, and the Hawaiians recognized that. And they managed things holistically from Makua to Makai, and everything was integrated. And so when we put this whole study together, we thought that the best thing to do would be to learn from the past. And so we recognized that they managed at a more of a decentralized level, more at the moku level or even the aupua'a level. Hmm. So we tried to have the biology reflect that.
So in terms of where we go from here, are there further lessons in terms of traditional Hawaiian cultural practices that could come into play here and management of fisheries?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can learn a lot from the past. The Hawaiians manage their resources quite effectively with fairly large populations in the past. I think pono practices, things like taking only what you need. But most important was probably recognizing spawning cycles. The Hawaiian moon calendar was used to most effectively manage when to fish, but more importantly, when not to fish. It's kind of the opposite of what we think about today as far as recognizing fishing practices. You know, we want to know when they knew when to lay off of fish, when they were spawning, when they were most susceptible. If you give fish a chance to spawn, they get to be big enough to spawn during the right times of year, you're going to have fish in the future.
Now, in order to sort of carry that forward, you're going to need buy-in from a lot of folks. Do you see that coming? I'm thinking of the commercial fishery side of life.
It's a complicated issue in the nearshore fisheries. Actually, the commercial fisheries only represent about 10% of the nearshore catch. It's primarily recreational users, cultural subsistence users. Everyone is part of the problem, so therefore everyone needs to be part of the solution.
So, and you had said that the study itself is really a first step to get the discussion going. So what kind of form does that discussion take, and who's involved in it?
There's already really good efforts afoot throughout the state at the community level. There's communities like in Haena on the north shore of Kauai that was the first legally designated community-based fisheries management area in the state. So applaud their efforts and the state's efforts for allowing that to move forward. There's other communities on Molokai, Momomi, on Hawaii Island. Kapolehu just has established a 10-year tri-wait period where they're going to, you know, let the area replenish itself, and areas in Mili'i. So there's communities out there that are trying to reestablish control over the area and try to decentralize it. And that's one great step in that direction. But it's going to be multiple steps. More conventional marine life conservation districts need to be established. The last one established was in 2003, so it's been a while. But people are just going to have to think about their overall footprint and how we can minimize that so that there's fish for the future.
You know, one of the interesting things about the study was you produced a very visual map showing fish density around the islands, and it seemed to track population. You know, the greater the human population, the less dense the fish population, which on a basic level seems to make sense. But what, again, in terms of moving ahead and taking action with this study, where does that lead you to?
So, yeah, there's a very clear correlation, more people, less fish, and vice versa. So we need to recognize where there's a lot of people, we need to have fairly concerted efforts and maybe, you know, think about pretty robust ways that we can manage these resources. In places where the human population density is still modest, those are the places that we should focus energies, because those reefs are healthy. Those reefs are still providing access to people. They're providing all the services that people want, you know, food, culture. It's all about, you know, lifestyle. So there's ways to do that, but it's on that continuum that we need to think about where we can most effectively manage. Not one size fits all. It's going to be a different solution for different problems. The state's complex. It took us a long time to get to where we are today, so there's not going to be one solution to this. It's going to be a multitude of solutions.
You know, the logistics also, again, it's very impressive just in terms of the study itself. Again, it's in a peer-reviewed journal, but it goes back, your information goes back nearly two decades, and tens of thousands of surveys in the water. How were you able to gather all this, and from various sources?
Yeah, so I myself spent a lot of time in the water and have been fortunate to see almost every reef from South Point up to Kure Atoll and everywhere in between. But this was a collective effort between Nature Conservancy, the State of Hawaii, Division of Aquatic Resources, NOAA, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And so we all got together and realized this bounty of data that we had. It's unprecedented at a global scale. For one particular location, there's never been this much data that existed. And then putting it all together was a job for one of my grad students who spent over a year, Mary Donovan, working on this. And, you know, to calibrate all this, because there's different methods that were used, different locations. So she really spent a lot of time calibrating all this. And it's really the most robust data that exists for any single location. So we're very confident in our findings.
Are there any other areas, just because the whole idea of reef health is so critical for Hawaii, are there other areas that this research can be applied to, or is this pretty much just the reef fishing at this point?
I think this can be applied across the board. I mean, it's lowering our footprint, whether it's using sustainable fishing practices or thinking about the footprints that we leave in along the coastal zone, but even in the upland area, I think is applicable to places outside of Hawaii. And again, you know, in Hawaii, each island has different needs and wants and community composition. But at the end of the day, 99% of the state of Hawaii is water. And so we all rely on a healthy ocean. At the World Conservation Congress last year, Governor Ige announced this 30 by 30 initiative to sustainably protect 30% of Hawaii's resources by 2030. And that was an announcement made on the world stage, very bold announcement. I think now is a time and a call to action to do something. We know what some of the problems are, and we need to move ahead with the solutions now.
And Alan, I get a feeling that we're going to be talking to you again as we move ahead with this.
I look forward to it. It's going to take a lot of people to, you know, work our way. But at the end of the day, a healthy ocean is going to be the best thing for all of us.
Good for all of us. Thank you, Alan. Alan Friedlander, Chief Scientist for National Geographic's Pristine Seas Project and Director of the Fisheries Ecology Research Lab at the University of Hawaii, also the lead author of a new research paper on fish density around the Hawaiian Islands, just published in the peer-reviewed journal Aquatic Conservation. Honolulu's city government is spending more money than ever before on overtime. Civil Beat's Natanya Friedheim has been working on that story, and she joins us this morning for today's reality check. So, Natanya, where's most of this overtime money going?
The two departments with the highest overtime budget are police and fire, for obvious reasons, because the departments address emergencies, and it's hard to predict, you know, when an emergency is going to happen, and people might have to stay in the case of an emergency to continue their shift and work into overtime.
So in terms of being able to anticipate and understand the point about police and fire, but is there any sense that beyond in areas elsewhere in the city that there are overtime payment areas that are going on that are perhaps not under as tight control as they might be?
Yeah, the reason this is coming up is because Councilmember Joey Manahan recently introduced a resolution urging the city and state governments to look into overtime abuse, which ultimately leads to something called pension spiking. And the reason he introduced this resolution is because a recent audit found that employees in the city's trash service, they were collecting a bulk item, bulk item pickup, they were abusing overtime, and some employees were taking excessive sick leave while others were making up for the absent employees by working lots of overtime. For example, in a 13-month period, the audit found that 10 employees with the highest overtime were earning over $400,000 in overtime pay.
And that's something, as you point out, it's this business of spiking, so basically adding the last years of within last years of employment as a city employee, boosting that by overtime so that the pension payments wind up being higher, which, again, is another higher long-term expense for the city.
Yes, it adds to the statewide unfunded liability for pensions for retired employees.
So in terms of where the city council wants to go with this right now, understand in terms of looking at numbers, reviewing numbers, any idea of sort of where that goes after finding out about the numbers?
Well, the first step is to find out about the numbers. The resolution is ultimately just to look into city government, different departments, and see where is overtime being abused, if it's other places besides just the trash collection service, and get a handle on how much money is going into overtime, and specifically who's abusing it and how.
So we can look forward to sort of a follow-up on once they track the numbers a bit.
Definitely. This is an ongoing conversation.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Natanya Friedheim. Thanks for joining us this morning. She's a reporting fellow with Civil Beat. You can find her entire article at civilbeat.org. You could say service organizations are an American tradition. The Peace Corps began under the administration of President Kennedy. Teach for America got underway when Bill Clinton was president. Many service organizations are focused on meeting specific needs, and those identified needs now include community information, local news. That's the target of a new service organization, Report for America, It's just getting underway. I spoke earlier with Steve Waldman, the project's co-founder. I started by asking him to lay out the general idea behind Report for America.
It's a national service program for journalists, and the idea is we have a crisis in local journalism especially. Newsrooms have just been decimated over the last decade, and it's really threatening democracy and people's ability to get the information that they need about health and schools and criminal justice. And so this is a program kind of modeled after Teach for America or Peace Corps, programs like that. We'll have a core of young journalists, and they'll be deployed out into local communities to do reporting about important topics embedded in local news organizations. So it's really geared to try to solve the kind of twin problems of journalism. There's sort of a crisis of the soul and a crisis of the pocketbook.
And if you look at issues from voter turnout to apathy by whatever metric you choose to measure it with, there's a bit of a crisis there as well. In terms of democracy, you see this as something that is helpful to democracy as well.
There's actual evidence that more and better news coverage of an election leads to higher turnout in that election. And it makes sense. You know, if you don't know what the issues are and how it affects you, it's going to seem less important to vote. And beyond voting, if you don't know your water is polluted, you can't demand that it be clean. And if you don't know that the mayor is embezzling money, you can't demand a new one or cleaning up City Hall. It's really pretty basic stuff. And it's something we all took for granted until recently. And it's kind of only slowly dawning on people that the collapse of local news organizations has really left a big void in many, many communities.
And a big part of that, of course, is the economic. How's the funding mechanism for this program work?
Well, it's not governmental. It's going to be privately funded and through donations and philanthropy, both on the national level and also on the local level. And basically, the way it's going to work is there's a national program, Report for America, and we will put in half of the salary for the core member, and then the other half comes from the local community. So part of that will be the news organization themselves. They've got to put in something, have some skin in the game. And then the other part will be local donors, small or large, conclude that it's really important and helpful for their community to have good journalism.
Now, I'm talking to you, obviously, from a public radio station in Hawaii. So the idea of nonprofit and news is something that in recent years certainly has taken on a different characteristic than traditionally in the years before. How does what you're doing work with that?
Well, public radio has been sort of doing this for a long time and has kind of proven the case in a way that, you know, local journalism doesn't have to mean a commercial model. And we have in other sectors, you know, universities and healthcare and hospitals, we already have a mix of commercial and nonprofit model. And public radio, in some ways, has been the sort of lonely voice in local communities. And so this will help with that. And the difference is we're not trying to start whole new organizations. We're trying to place reporters in local news organizations that are already showing signs of innovation and commitment to public service journalism. We're not going to start, you know, creating whole new newspapers. We're going to want to place folks in the areas where there's already this commitment.
And this idea of Report for America grew out of work that you did at the Federal Communications Commission, and this report on information needs of communities, supermarkets. People talk about food desert. Have you found information deserts in terms of the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great analogy, because I think a lot of times when people were talking about the problems of journalism, it sounded like it was really about the journalists. You know, the journalists are losing their jobs, and that really is not the point or the big problem. The problem is what happens when you don't have a healthy kind of journalism ecosystem in a community is people don't get information that they need. Just as if you have supermarket deserts, you can't feed yourself well, or you'll be paying more for your food, or you'll have lower quality food. Same thing is true if you're in a news desert. And news deserts are places where there are, you know, too few reporters covering the community. And news deserts can be, you know, literally deserts or out in rural areas, sparsely populated. Or they can be urban areas where certain communities are undercovered or certain topics are undercovered. It really comes down to the fact that the business model for sustaining kind of a labor-intensive reporting, where you're really working on a story for, you know, more than 3 hours, has collapsed. And so in some ways, journalists have never been more productive, you know, in terms of measured by, you know, words per reporter. But the pressures are so intense to make that more superficial. And we need to give journalists the ability to really spend some time on stories that are actually really important for the community, are not just about clickbait and generating traffic, but actually will help, you know, residents and citizens strengthen their own communities.
Bob Schieffer, old line CBS News guy, has a new book out, and in it he cites a study that found that a few years ago, 1 in 8 journalists working in the United States worked in New York, Washington, or Los Angeles. And that figure apparently is now 1 in 5. What does that tell you?
Yeah, and I think that is caused not so much by an increase in people in New York, D.C., or Los Angeles, as a decrease everywhere else. Mm. And that is a big problem. It means that, well, for one thing, as we saw with the election, means that people on the coasts don't really understand people in the rest of the country very well. And people in the rest of the country don't understand each other. You know, it basically leads or contributes to the kind of collapse of mutual understanding if you don't have people on the ground telling both the people in the community and the people outside of the community what's going on.
Let me ask you this, Steve. As you look out, metrics are so difficult in journalism, in life generally, but in journalism. What sort of metrics or what sort of ideas do you have that will tell you that this project is becoming a success as you go forward with this? What are you looking
for? That's a great question because we've shied away from using the, you know, kind of easiest to count metrics, like number of stories or something like that.
Exactly.
That almost would exacerbate the problem. We really want them to have an impact on their communities. So to some degree, we're going to be hearing, you know, looking for ways of actually measuring whether there's been some sort of community impact, looking for measures whether the newsroom is happy with the reporter, that they've done good work. You know, this is not just about giving a good experience to the reporter, though I think it will be, you know, formative for them. They have to actually be doing good journalism. So that's the kind of metric we're going to be looking for. The other thing is I think we'll be looking to make sure that there's some buy-in from the community. You know, there is this element that you have to raise a certain amount of money from the community. And that'll be interesting. That'll be a way of measuring, you know, whether people in the area are really buying into this idea and concluding that good local journalism is important for the health of a city or a town.
How do people apply for this?
Go to the website reportforamerica.org, and there's a form there, very short, and fill out your name and some information. And this actually applies both for people who want to be reporters and news organizations that want to receive Report for America Corps members. And gives your information. We will get back to you soon with a more formal application.
Thanks, Steve. Steve Waldman is longtime journalist, entrepreneur, co-founder of Report for America. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is the conversation for this Thursday, October 5th, which also happens to be day 9 of our pledge drive at member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Speaking of which, now we go back to Pledge Central with Ray Cruz. Ray.